This is Vis-a-Vis, a podcast series brought to you by the Alliance Program at Columbia University. Vis-a-Vis features conversations that challenge our understanding of key global, economic, and social issues by casting them in a transatlantic perspective. I'm Emmanuel Catan. I head the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University and three French universities, Sciences Po, Paris Panthéon-Sorbonne, and École Polytechnique. Every episode, I sit down face-to-face with, or as we say in French, vis-a-vis, some of the most insightful thinkers on both sides of the Atlantic. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Over the last few years, the rise of artificial intelligence has been reshaping many areas of our lives, from healthcare to law, from self-driving cars to self-written novels. AI promises to transform our relationship with the world and remodel our interactions with our fellow human beings. In the era of climate research, AI is proving to be a powerful tool. In particular, the use of AI to develop powerful predictive models, even for such elusive and seemingly random phenomena as precipitations, can provide scientists and policymakers with tools that can help mitigate the effects of climate change and generate strategies to adapt to its consequences. In order to better understand how exactly AI can improve climate models and empower climate scientists to respond to the threat of global warming, Vis-a-Vis is honored to welcome Pierre Gentine, professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Engineering at Columbia University. Pierre Gentine is also the director of the NSF Science and Technology Center, Learning the Earth with Artificial Intelligence in Physics, or LEAP, and a director of graduate program in the Earth and Environmental Engineering Department. Dr. Gentine and his group investigate the multi-scale nature of the continental hydrologic and carbon cycle with observations, models, and machine learning. Professor Gentine, welcome to Vis-a-Vis.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start with a naive question. Why do we need climate modeling? For several decades, we've known about the effects of greenhouse gases and the threat they pose to humankind's survival. We're familiar with the effects of extreme weather. We've been witnessing the intensity of wildfires, floods, heat waves, hurricanes. And we know also what the solutions are. We know that we need to reduce our carbon emissions, among other things. And if we don't act quickly, our planet will become soon uninhabitable. Why do we need an accurate picture of the future in addition to this? Why not simply focus all our efforts on developing alternative renewable energy, technology for carbon capture, etc.?
Thanks. And first, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. We do need climate modeling for multiple aspects and multiple components. The first one is policy making, right? So most of you most likely have heard about the Paris Agreement. When we talk about 2 degrees of warming compared to pre-industrial level, what we use in the background, and we don't really mention that, are climate models. So in the background, to talk about those 2 degrees and what are kind of the allowable emissions to get there, we use climate models. So models are used to infer or define how much emissions and carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas we can basically put up in the atmosphere to reach those limits. And they provide kind of, if you will, a timeline or some aspects we can clarify when we will reach that particular level. So there's the policy aspect of that. The second component, I would say, which is very dear to my heart, is thinking about adaptation and thinking not just at the global scale, but starting to think at a more regional, more local scale. And that's a place where we need to know what's coming up next, right? So are we going to be witnessing more flooding events, more droughts, more intense rainfall, sea level rise? And for that, we are going to use that information to adapt potentially, hopefully, and to build potentially new type of infrastructure or to adjust the way we would be planning. So that component is going to be very critical from a planning perspective. So we know where we should go. I mean, there are some places that are going to be inhabitable where we would not want to live. And that's also very important to know that a priori. And so we are going to use that information to plan the future, hopefully. A third part where we can use those models is to also understand how much the land and the ocean are helping us. The biosphere, so the land biosphere and the ocean have been playing a huge favor to us in terms of picking up huge amounts of carbon dioxide. So about one third for the land, a little bit less for the ocean, but a very, very large fraction of the emissions that we put up as humans is being picked up by the ocean and the land. And that really mitigates a huge amount of global warming. And if they were to diminish in terms of being a very, very large sinks, that could have major dreadful consequences to us, because it would mean that every time we emit, a lot more will actually stay in the atmosphere, and therefore we'll have more impact as a greenhouse gas and therefore warm up the planet faster. So that's something we want to know and we want to actually understand. And then the final point I would think that's also very important is thinking about what we call counterfactual, what if questions. You know, what if we were to take that particular action? What if we were to do this? You know, reducing, for instance, the most basic question would be reducing greenhouse gas emissions over some period of time. But we can do more than that. You know, imagine we are changing the albedo or the reflection or the type of cover that we have at the land surface. What's the impact of that? What's the impact of droughts? You know, so we can ask many such what if questions. And that's kind of the beauty of those physically based models, because they are rooted in physics. They should be able to provide some response to some of that. You know, for another example would be, what's the impact of irrigation on climate? You know, there could be some major impact of irrigation at the large scale on climate. So those are many questions we can answer with such models. So they are very much needed. And then to maybe close the loop on your question, I would say, why do they need to be precise? Is because all of those questions require a relatively granular type of response, right? We cannot say it's going to be raining more or less in the future. That's not sufficient, right? We need to be quantifying the change, and that's going to be informing a lot of policymakers, for instance, water resource management agencies, and so on and so forth, right? So we need to provide a detailed and an accurate picture of the future.
Right. And I think in addition to policy, perhaps creating confidence and trust among the general population about these predictions is also very important. So getting precise predictions is a way of countering, perhaps, or contributing to countering climate skeptics.
Exactly. And building trust. You're exactly right. Yeah. And maybe we'll get back to this talking about AI as well.
Exactly. But to come back to the issue of policy and getting exact or as precise as possible predictions, one question that I'm asking myself is also, why is it so difficult? Are predictions so difficult because there are many parameters when you're talking about the climate that need to be considered at the same time? Or is it about the causal links between these different factors that are multidimensional and therefore extremely difficult to predict? And how does AI really provide us with the tools to create more granular and more precise predictions?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I would say it's actually both. But rooted into that is really the fact that the Earth is a very complex system, right? So even trying to predict what humans are going to do and what they are going to do tomorrow, next year, or within the next decade is going to be extremely challenging, and that's pretty obvious. There are many physical processes that are very important for the long-term climate, you know, and things that we experience and we witness and we see every day. I would say potentially some of the most important ones are clouds. Climate models tend to be very coarse in scale right now because we are limited by the compute power that we have. And to give you a sense, a typical grid size, roughly speaking, is about 100 kilometers. So you could think of that, it's a very pixelated view of the world, so like almost like a very old video game. So it looks not very granular, not as what we would hope. And within that big pixel, we need to make up for many clouds that we don't really see, right? Because we can't really resolve them because they are too small. And so we need to have some sort of empirical methods to make up for clouds that we don't really see, right? So, and to kind of understand their average impact, you know, we might have hundreds of clouds within that grid box and we don't really see them. So we need to simulate them somehow and very empirically. So there are many, many approximations to your point about parameters. There are many things or degrees of freedom we don't really understand, you know, and especially related to clouds. Turbulence is another one in the atmosphere and the ocean. You have other things such as what we call gravity waves. You can sometimes see those waves. So those things are actually very crucial for climate, but they tend to be extremely complex and would require computational power that we will not have in our lifetime, you know, most likely. So that's one thing. The other thing is that there are also processes that we don't understand altogether. And I would say that's, for me, one of my very big interests is thinking about the land, right? And it's very obvious when you just walk into a landscape, you walk into a city, the complexity is mind-blowing, right? So from buildings to trees and leaves, you know, and branches. So you can't capture all of that complexity. And with that comes biology, right? And biology, we understand physics to some extent, right? We have some good physical laws, but biology sometimes defies our understanding, right? It's very, very challenging to understand. Imagine you have many, many, like billions or even more microbes, right, in a particular area. So how do you deal with that? How do you represent that? And they can be very important, for instance, on the carbon cycle. So again, that's a place where you need to use some sort of empirical, relatively ad hoc type representation of those things. Not that they are not important. They are very, very important, but we just don't understand the system perfectly. And that leads to what we could call like a compound effect of many, many uncertainties that are compounded all together and that are leading to a lot of those uncertainties that we are talking about. And the fact that climate models tend to be relatively uncertain for certain aspects. You know, some things are obvious, right? The fact that the planet is warming is obvious and all models agree. But the details of that, the location of that, the change in precipitation, or the change in the carbon cycle, those are places where you have very large uncertainties because they relate to some of those very important details, okay? And the details matter in that overall picture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So obviously we don't know the future, but we do know a little bit about the past, and maybe we know quite a bit about the past. So to what extent is past data useful in order to create models that can predict the future? I mean, couldn't we, and maybe this is also a naive question, but couldn't we take, for example, a 10-year period, look at different parameters that are of interest to us at the beginning and see, you know, what impact they have, whether it's, you know, precipitation or the carbon cycle, as you're mentioning, or even the thawing of the permafrost. So you take all these different parameters on day one, and then 10 years later, you see where you are, you have data about that, and then you create a theoretical model to express that transformation and then apply it to the future. Is that part of how you reason as well, and how does the past give you a tool, in other words, to refine also predictions about the future?
So I would say, yes, you're right. And we've been using historical data to some extent, and that's been very standard practice, I would say. And not just over the last couple of decades, people have used very, very long timescales, you know, what we call paleoclimate. So thinking about, you know, thousands of years or even more. Maybe the first thing is to think about historically how we were building those models. The strategy was, as I think that's a tendency as humans, we believe we know, and then we basically develop equations. Sometimes it's quite informed, you know, by physics, but sometimes it's much less informed, we could argue. And then what we do is we build those equations, and they have a few knobs, like a few parameters, as you mentioned before, that you need to tweak and tune to make sure that they are accurate. And then what you do is you expose that, as you said, to past data to tune and tweak those parameters. So that was, I would say, the strategy. There are different ways of doing that. Different modeling centers focus on different things. Some people are very invested in clouds. Some people are invested in different things. That's very much the culture of the lab. And I would say over the last couple of years, we've seen a different strategy. For instance, some of the things we've been doing as part of LEAP at Columbia and with collaborators and satellite institutions is to use a different approach, where what we say is that instead of kind of trying to make up or invent the laws, we are just exposing the algorithm to the data. And we are trying to learn the laws directly from the data, you could say. You know, so that's a very different strategy in the sense that we directly use, could be observations. It could be also more accurate simulations, like where a simulation where you can resolve some of those clouds. And we expose those algorithms to that to actually make up for those things and to do a better job at representing them. So that would be another strategy. Now, I would say the standard issue is that we've never seen temperatures or conditions that we are going to be witnessing in the future. You could actually make a prediction that doesn't make sense, right? Because it's never been trained on such data. So that's something we are, I would say the AI community has been very well aware of. I would say the physical community or the physical science community tend to be maybe or tend to believe that the physical laws will actually buy them the capacity to extrapolate, but that's not always true. You know, so sometimes it's actually good to also use some of that framing to think about the fact that there are conditions that we are going to experience in the future that we've never seen in the past. So the past sometimes is not the best predictor of the future. On top of that, there are also things that could be challenging in the sense that when we look at the past, a lot of things were evolving at the same time. So we had, for instance, the greenhouse gas emissions, yes. But in the background, we also had aerosols, you know. There were a lot of aerosols that were emitted at the same time. And there were multiple regulations, you know, for instance, you know, on cars and such, which led to a reduction oftentimes, you know, in pollution, which is a good thing. But for a while, the aerosols were kind of cooling off some of the planet, right? So they were mitigating some of climate change, you could say. And then eventually that actually started to decay, that impact, you know. And so there are things that can be correlated or evolving at the same time, which can lead to confusing responses, you know, and that can be another challenge, right? So it's not just greenhouse gases, but it could be multiple factors that are evolving at the same time or co-evolving. And that can lead to challenges when we want to, again, tune or tweak those knobs.
Right, right. And could you give us an example in your research of how AI has completely changed the way in which we predict future climate impact compared to traditional models?
Yeah, I would say the first one, so that's trying to represent what we call convection, which are deep clouds in the tropics, you know, those clouds that are strongly precipitating, that are a huge challenge for climate models and extremely important. And that's a place where we replaced the representation of those clouds by AI. And that worked quite well. So we were pretty pleased with the results. We got into the same issues that you just mentioned, the fact that can you extrapolate to a warmer Earth? Is that working or not? We realized it was not working. And we've been doing a lot of work trying to make sure that those algorithms can extrapolate to a warmer planet. So it's been quite a bit of a bumpy road, but I think we are getting there to some extent. So that's a place where we've seen good, I would say, developments, you know. There has been quite a bit of development as well in the ocean community and colleagues trying to represent turbulence in the ocean, which is also a huge challenge. And they could show, and they have been showing, that using AI that could actually be improving things dramatically. There's been also one thing where AI is proving to be extremely useful is to get from this very pixelated view of the world to something much crisper, right? To something much more detailed. And you could think of that, it's actually very similar to what we do when we use DALL-E. I don't know if you've been playing with DALL-E, this image generation, right? You have a prompt and you generate an image, right? So it's the same. You could say the prompt is the coarse pixel, right? It's telling you what is the average condition. And what you want to do is generate very fine scale image, right? And that's the same, like generate some precipitation, generate some temperature field, given the prompt being the coarse scale. So it's exactly the same process. And we are using the exact same models, which are called diffusion models. So that's a place where AI, I think, could have a huge impact. We call that downscaling. So going from the coarse resolution to fine scale resolution. The final place, it's a little bit outside of that scope, but I think it's very important, is we've been witnessing a revolution in weather forecasting. Many, many companies now are starting to use AI-based weather forecasts. And that's a huge change because those models were always based on physics, and that's changing extremely rapidly. Over the last 5 years, we went from proof of concept to operational, and kind of one of the standard or reference weather centers in the world, ECMWF, the European Center for Medium Weather Forecast, is now using operationally an AI-based forecast system. So that's a huge revolution.
Right, right. And hopefully it's not putting too many people out of a job either, because I can imagine that using AI to predict the weather given how important that is to so many people, that might have an impact also on the jobs of meteorologists. But I wanted to go back to the effects of climate on human beings, and in particular on the global south. And we know that the impact, for example, of sea level rise can be really literally tragic to small island states. There are predictions that some small islands will disappear within the next few decades. Is climate change for you also a social justice issue? And to what extent, again, can AI-based models help improve actions that are aimed at mitigating the effects of climate change on the most vulnerable in the world?
We talk a lot about biases, you know, from AI. You know, a very common example is on race. You know, like there were many examples where people use as training data pictures of people that tended to be more white, you know, and that led to biases when they were trying to apply that to people of color. It's kind of the same, you could say, for AI, for climate or weather. There's going to be a bias based on where you observe, right? And that's something I've been very interested in. Like, how can we reduce that potential bias? Because we typically have fewer observations, especially in the tropics. Those are places that are difficult to get access to. Or even when we have satellite observations, you tend to have a lot of clouds, so you cannot really see the surface oftentimes. So they are pretty important biases in terms of where and when we observe the Earth. And that could lead to an imperfect view or biased view of the world, right? So, and we can develop, and there are techniques to develop algorithms that are less biased, that take that into account. We can correct some of that. So that's one approach we can have. The second aspect, and I think for me that's quite exciting, I would say, is to think about the fact that AI-based models, once they are trained, that's a very expensive part, you know, to train them. But once they are trained, to use them is actually very cheap. We talked about weather forecasting models. Now, you can almost run a weather forecasting model almost on your laptop, right? Or you can run a lot of things on the cloud. You know, you don't need a huge infrastructure locally to get those things running. And that's a huge leverage and huge empowering, I think, for many people that might not have access to those compute power. And I think we are just at the very, very early stage, but I would suspect that in 10 years from now, we are going to see a lot more decentralized way of thinking about climate, looking at climate impact. And for instance, one thing we are trying to do as part of LEAP is also to empower people in terms of access to climate data. So we are developing, it's not just based on AI, there's some aspect of that for the algorithm, but not a whole lot. But the idea is to put all of the data on the cloud, the compute is done on the cloud, and then people can directly use the data, which is really cheap, on their laptop, because all of the compute and all of the data is non-local. So to me, it's a huge empowerment, especially in the global south. So we are really trying to push on that front as part of LEAP to make sure that people can get access to the information. And AI can be also a huge empowerment here, in the sense that we could translate. And people always think that data and science should be in English, but now we can translate very, very, very accurately and very easily with those AI-based, for instance, large language models such as ChatGPT. And very few people are looking into that, but that could be a huge success, right? To think about adaptation and to think about framing. How do we frame science in a way that's accessible, right? To think about, can you digest that data and explain that to a high school teacher, to a kid? So that's a very, very exciting area, very underexplored in my perspective, but something that I think will be exploding in the next couple of years.
And a big part of adaptation, I imagine, is also to do with information and trusting the information we have. And we know, you know, how challenging climate skepticism can be, you know, for policymakers and for all those who are concerned with mitigating the impact of climate change. So to end our conversation, I'd like perhaps to get your views on how AI-based models can build trust in scientists and in the information that they provide, not just to policymakers, but also to the general public. Can AI, you know, improve the way in which we communicate about climate change and help create greater buy-in as well for collective decision making?
I think that's, I would almost say, the main question right now. For instance, A good example is for weather forecasting, right? So now we can have those AI-based models, but people still trust them less, you know, because they are based on AI. They don't really understand the AI that's behind that, and it's quite complex as opposed to physics-based models. I don't know. I think I've changed my view in the sense that I think we put a lot of belief in our physical understanding as well, and we know that the models that we build are also not perfect, you know? So the trust could be also stated in terms of the physics-based models, I would say. But that's going to be a huge potential bottleneck. And that's true for weather, but for weather, we have like weather every day, so we can kind of check. For climate, that's going to be a huge bottleneck, right? So do we trust that prediction, right? Or is it something that you wouldn't want your climate model based on AI to be hallucinating, right? That would be the worst thing that could happen, right? So you're right, there's going to be some trust and we need to have checks and multiple checks. I would say one thing we sometimes undersell is that when we are using those AI-based models, most people were actually coming from physics, right? And I think people have been so cautious, right? That we've been checking and double checking and triple checking and building huge data sets to check and recheck. And we never did that type of check for regular physics-based model. So that's also a huge benefit for this community because we never did that in the past and we never took the time to actually really check, you know, what those models were doing to that extent. You know? And I think because now we are so overly cautious because we want to make sure that those models are doing such a good job in all particular conditions possible. And we never, never, ever did that to that extent for regular models. So that's a very positive development. The last thing I would say is that oftentimes those models will be cheaper to run. And what I can witness right now already is that we see a lot more students and young people involved. And you have many pairs of eyes now on those models, whereas before it was just a few scientists that would actually know how to run those very complex models. So that, to me, provide a lot of trust, you know, because there are many, many people checking and rechecking and reading those codes, and we didn't have that before. So that's a way to build collective understanding. We open source everything typically, and that wasn't really the case. Some models have been doing that for quite a few years, physically based model, but I think that's a very positive development, you know, that in the community and really a change of mindset. You know, I'm very much welcoming that, I would say.
Well, on this encouraging note, I'd like to thank you, Professor Gentine, for being so generous and insightful. And we will also put the link to your LEAP Research Center on the Vis-a-Vis website for everyone who is listening to us. Thank you so much again, Professor Gentine.
Thank you so much for having me.
Vis-a-Vis is brought to you by the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University, Paris-Panthéon-Sorbonne, Sciences Po, and École Polytechnique. This podcast is produced by Monica Hunter-Hart and Georgia O'Neill, and I'm Emmanuel Catan. Special thanks to Columbia Libraries. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. If you're interested in learning more about the Alliance Program and how we support academic exchanges, research, and collaboration between the US and France, please visit us at alliance.columbia.edu or follow us on Facebook, Twitter X, and Instagram. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.